Thanks for joining us on The Record today. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke, and we're starting the show with a piece published on KUOW.org this week. An underwear maker, his boy models, and the sleuth who tried to stop him. This is the headline for that magazine-length story. It's the story of Tiger Underwear, a Washington company that used pictures of boys in underwear to help sell its product. It's also the story of a mysterious man with a secret who tried unsuccessfully to stop the company. Joining me now is the reporter who wrote the story, our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. And just a warning to listeners, if you have kids with you now, you might want to wait and listen to this later. Hi, Austin. How did you come across this story?
Well, my editor, former editor, actually stumbled across Tiger Underwear a couple of years ago when she was shopping online for underwear for her son. And she was surprised and disturbed by the images of the boy models. From a parent's perspective, she thought they were inappropriate. And it made her wonder what the law was, whether these photos went too far. Once she discovered that Tiger Underwear was based here in Washington State, she thought there might be a story to be told, and she suggested that I look into it.
So what did you discover?
Tiger Underwear was founded about a decade ago. It's based in University Place, Washington, near Tacoma, and it's run by a guy named David Anderson. And he and I spoke last May. One time we were able to connect. This was early on in my research. And I asked him why he was using boys to model his old-fashioned tighty-whitey underwear. And he said it was because that's what helped sell the underwear. And he was adamant that there was nothing inappropriate about this. In fact, he said he was trying to bring back not only a higher quality form of vintage underwear like the department stores used to sell decades ago, but also that sort of old school style of advertising from years gone by.
So that's what David Anderson had to say, but what did your research turn up?
Well, I spent a lot of time looking at how Tiger Underwear had used its boy models over the years. I dug through the archives of the company's website. I found stuff that you certainly don't see in mainstream advertising today. For instance, there was a video of boys in underwear wrestling on the ground. There was another video of a boy alone on a beach who undresses down to his underwear. There were photos of boys in underwear having squirt gun fights and pillow fights. There was also a Tiger Underwear blog where the boy models were introduced to customers, and those customers could then help name them, give them model names. And I found that the company produced catalogs with boys on the cover that you could get if you became a Tiger member. Now, I do want to be clear, the kids were not always stripped down to their briefs in all these photos. They were often dressed, but with their underwear showing, like the top of the underwear showing above their jeans line, for instance. And I also should mention that Tiger Underwear also used adult models.
Well, when you did get to talk to David Anderson, what did he tell you about the models, the boy models, and how he found them?
He was pretty tight-lipped about it. He said that he had worked with a couple of photographers and talent companies, one on the East Coast, one in the West. He wouldn't tell me their names, but he did say he had personally attended many of the photo shoots. He said the parents of the models were there as well, and we tracked down a couple of the parents of the models who confirmed this. Their reaction to the photos ranged from unconcerned about the photos to not sure what to make of them to very disconcerted. Eventually, we were able to identify the photographers and discovered that one of them went to federal prison for distributing child pornography, and the other is awaiting trial on child pornography charges in Nevada and has another case pending in California. Now, I do want to be clear that there is no connection between those cases, those criminal cases, and the work that those photographers would have done in the past for Tiger Underwear.
Austin, you've told us about David Anderson, the man who runs Tiger Underwear, but there's another person in this story as well. We called him the mystery sleuth in the introduction. Who is this person?
Yeah, the story just got more interesting the more I looked into it. So there's this guy named Patrick Murphy. He lives in Seattle now. He's from Illinois originally. And he came across the Tiger Underwear site several years ago, and he started something of a crusade to try to stop the company from using boy models. He managed to identify a couple of the models, and he contacted officials in the state of Maine about his concerns. That's where those models were from. That led to an article in the newspaper there warning parents to be wary of modeling opportunities, especially if it involves posing your child in underwear. Murphy also contacted police and prosecutors all over the country, alerting them to these images. And the response back that he got was pretty universal. Yes, these images seem inappropriate. Some of the police used the term child erotica, but the consensus was they're not illegal.
The images are not illegal. Okay. Well, what did you learn about Patrick Murphy?
Well, eventually I had enough information about him to run a background check. And lo and behold, I discovered that Charles Patrick Murphy is a former high school teacher from Bainbridge Island who pled guilty back in 2006, so more than a decade ago, to possession of child pornography. So I confronted him with this, and I asked him point blank, what's going on here? Obviously, I wanted to know if, you know, what his motivation was. Was he part of some group of maybe sex offenders who police the internet after their conviction? Or if he does this as an excuse to continue to look at images of boys online? He insisted that he was concerned for the safety of the models, especially because they seem to have attracted a fan base of men online. And he also allowed that he was perhaps trying to atone for what he had done himself in the past.
Wow. Well, when you talk to the police about these images, about this entire story with Tiger Underwear, what do they say about all of this?
I spoke with Washington's Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, ICAC is the shorthand for that. It says that it has investigated Tiger Underwear more than once based on tips it's gotten. But each time they've done that, the conclusion has been that the images do not constitute child exploitation. You know, the law is very clear that in order for an image of a child to be illegal, it has to show children engaged in sexually explicit conduct, or the image has to constitute what's known as a lascivious exhibition of the child's private parts. There's a lot of case law on this. Child erotica is a term that police often use to describe images that don't cross that legal line, but are going to appeal to the sexual interest of some adults. But again, child erotica is not illegal.
Well, what's David Anderson's response to all of this? He's the owner of Tiger Underwear. How does he respond to this discussion over his photographs, over Patrick Murphy's crusade, the police investigations?
I didn't get to ask him. So after that initial conversation we had back in May, David stopped responding to my requests for a follow-up interview. I could not get him to respond again. Now, in our first conversation, he told me he had never been contacted by law enforcement, and he seemed bewildered that anyone would question the motives behind the pictures. But once I started asking questions about Tiger Underwear, the Tiger Underwear website and social media accounts changed a lot. Images were taken down, Facebook comments were deleted, and if you go to the website today, you will see that there are no photos except for a male model and a boy model, and they're wearing black Tiger t-shirts. So the website has a very different feel today than it did even just a few months ago.
Wow. Well, as you pointed out, Austin, there's a difference between explicitly illegal images of children and child erotica, as law enforcement calls it. But has there been any talk of changing child exploitation laws because of this?
I asked Captain Mike Edwards of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force that question. He's with the Seattle Police Department. He says there have been discussions, and he says that Washington state lawmakers continue to talk about this issue with him and other police and prosecutors. But there are, at this point, no formal proposals to change the law here in Washington. Captain Edwards did note that other states have taken steps to crack down on images of children that get into this sort of gray area. I know that there's a law in West Virginia, but it only applies to images of children where there's no product being sold in connection with those images. It's also true, and I talked to lawyers about this, that there's a clear tension with freedom of expression and the First Amendment. When is an image innocent? When is it art? And when is it child erotica? This is thorny stuff.
Well, Austin Jenkins, KUOW's Olympia correspondent, thank you for looking into this and thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.
A rocky season for the Seattle Seahawks all comes down to this weekend. To make the playoffs, the Seahawks have to win, and the Atlanta Falcons have to lose. But if the Seahawks aren't really winning as much as you might like, if you want more reliable gridiron dominance, there's another local football team you might want to root for. They went 7-1 this year and won a division title.
My name is Alicia Edlin, and I play defensive end and fullback.
Mackenzie Tolliver, and I play safety, receiver, and punt return.
You just had to put that in there.
Always. It's my favorite.
Alicia and Mackenzie play for the Seattle Majestics, an all-women's tackle football team. Earlier this year, Alicia and Mackenzie told me what it's like to play football in a place where they're overshadowed by one, sometimes two, other football teams. You have the ears of tens of thousands of people when this airs who have probably never heard of the Seattle Majestics.
Okay.
What do you want them to know?
We're awesome.
Jinx. What do we want them to know? We look like a men's tackle football team. Obviously, there's some technical things and speed of play is a little different. But like, if you look at the line, it's a line. So it's really cool to watch because you feel like you're watching football just like you are anywhere else. So, you know, we put our helmets on and you can't totally tell that we're a female sports team, which to me as an athlete, I take a lot of pride in.
How do you know that men don't expect you to know that much about football?
You can tell when you have conversations. They do. And some men get offended when you talk to them and you're like, well, you know, if you run this play or we do this because they're like, well, of course I know that. You know, they're like kind of intimidated by, I think, women's football intelligence sometimes. But you can tell by the way they ask. Not all of them. So no disrespect because we have some great coaches that,
oh, yeah, definitely,
that talk to us like we already know. You know, they're very respectful, but there are some that they're very skeptical about what we really know about football. And I would say it isn't until they come see us play. The skeptics become unskeptical when they come see us play and they see it all put together. And then you have conversations with them and they're like, oh, okay.
When you get to tell people now that you play tackle football, when you tell other people,
mm-hmm,
I play for the Majestics, what kind of response do you get?
I laugh because the first response I get is that most people don't know that there's women's tackle football outside of the LFL. So I get a lot of questions about that. And then I have to tell people that, no, we play 11 on 11, full tackle. We're fully geared up, fully suited.
Somebody tell me what LFL stands for.
Well, it's Legends Football League.
Yes.
But it's the Lingerie Football League.
Okay.
Yeah, the Seattle Mist.
I'm sorry, I have to ask this question. How often is it that you tell somebody you play football and they assume that you're a member of the Mist, that you play lingerie football?
Probably about 4 out of 5 times.
And it takes them a minute to process. I mean, all due respect, they've given themselves a name around here. You know, people go to their games and people know who they are. So either people have been to their games or, you know, there was some a series on TV and stuff like that. So it takes them a minute to just fully process, like, whoa, this is like the down and dirty. This is real, like, full pads, 11v11, mm-hmm, you know, full field football. So it takes them a minute to process and, like, shift their mindset to the different dynamic that our football brings versus the, mm-hmm, lingerie league.
So, Mackenzie, when you have that conversation, it sounds like you're both fairly well-versed in having this conversation.
Yes.
When you have this conversation and someone responds with the assumption that you play for the Mist, mm-hmm, and not for the Majestics, how do you walk them through what happens?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've gotten so good at it now. My first few wasn't so easy, but they don't come straight out and ask. I mean, I think the word lingerie makes people uncomfortable. For me personally, people kind of look at me and you can tell in their mind, they're like, okay, so you lingerie. Like they're looking at you thinking lingerie football league, right? So I just say, and just to clarify, there are two different leagues and I just explain the leagues through to them and explain, you know, everything that goes along with our league versus the lingerie league.
Alicia, is that how you handle it?
Mackenzie is a little more feminine than I am. So I kind of just crack a joke. I'm like, do you really think that I'm going to run around half naked looking like this? But honestly, I just basically say, no, we play 11 on 11 tackle football. And generally, I'll show them a highlight video that we have.
Or, yeah, and that helps, too, is in explaining to people, I'll pull up a picture of, you know, either the team or myself in full pads right away so that not only have I explained it, I'm like, no, like, this is legit. You know, this is full pads. Because then you'll say full pads, but they're still like, like, full pads? Like, yes. Like, yeah. Helmet, shoulder pads, leg pads, everything. Yeah. So sometimes just creating a visual form really seals the deal.
I have to ask, I mean, I know that you both work full time. Scheduling you both to come in wasn't easy because you work. Mackenzie, you have kids. this is not an issue for the Seahawks. Playing is their full-time jobs. I mean, what is it like to play for a team while seeing another team that everybody else here seems to love and care about, knowing that they get to make a living doing that?
I'm just at a position where it's just reality right now. So I try not to let it discourage you. And rather, I'm in a position of trying to improve the sport and empower females to play. We may not see that happen in our generation of football, but it motivates me to get other players to have that opportunity. Because how cool would it be to literally play football for a living, whether you're male or female?
I mean, it can be frustrating that women's sports isn't at the same level as men's sports. And like Mackenzie said, it is the reality of things, but we're in a position to where we can change that. There's leagues coming up that are all female young girls playing tackle football. Those are the ones who are going to be the ones who see the change that we're trying to make in the football community, that men just don't play football. Women do too. And we can hit, we can run the ball, we can catch, we can do everything that the guys can do.
Alicia and Mackenzie, I talked with one of your teammates, Adrienne Wilson. She said that she remembered when she first started playing for the Majestics. So she's been on the team for more than a decade.
Yeah, she's the granddaddy.
Yeah, yeah. Granddaddy Majestic.
She remembers practicing on elementary school baseball fields. That was one of the things she told me.
Mm-hmm.
And now the team practices on turf. The team plays on turf. And she said that was, for her, a real marker of progress in football for women. She could see that as a huge leap forward, right? So I'm wondering how each of you have seen the sport progress since each of you have started playing. Mackenzie, what about you? You've been on the team for 3 years now.
I mean, it's come a long ways. I mean, again, not in just my 3 years, but from my knowledge of before, is like, that's an example of like not playing on turf fields. The fact that we have, how many teams do we have in the WFA?
60.
Yeah, definitely over 50. And it's more and more prominent. There's young girls that are playing in high school. We actually have a girl in the league who is in high school, and she's playing quarterback in our league. So it's super cool. Like, she's playing for her high school and she's playing in our league. So that would probably be the one testament of progress, is having, you know, young girls who are playing football at the next level for women already. Like, she's already setting herself up. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we've come a long ways. We have a long ways to go still, but the fact that we're not, you know, driving up, playing on grass fields, shining our lights on the fields, you know, from our cars, just to be able to play longer is huge.
Alicia, how have you seen the sport progress since you've played over the last 6 years?
One of the main things is our games are starting to be broadcasted now. I mean, not on major stations, but internet shows. Like, we stream on Facebook Live to get our games out there. There are still teams who practice on grass fields, so it's still in progress. There weren't any leagues for young girls to play in when I first started playing. That's awesome to me, just the fact that there's enough girls who want to play football that they have their own leagues now, not just at an adult level, but at a 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old level.
We were down in Orlando for Women's World Games in January. It may have been one of the coolest moments of my life seeing female sports progress. Is there was a flag tournament, like a national flag tournament for all ages.
Like flag football?
Yeah, flag football. Starting at like 8 and going all the way up to 18. And there was full girls teams starting at 8 or 9 years old up until 18. And it was super cool to watch them play. These girls, they're spending their time playing flag football, which is the next step, you know, is having full teams in full tournaments around the country. And at a national level, I mean, that's a national level tournament for them. So that was a really clarifying moment for me that we're definitely making progress.
So if you had to look 20 years down the road, what do you think women's football is going to look like?
I think about this all the time. Without what I want and what I think, I have to separate those two things.
What do you want? Let's start there.
Yeah, what I want is I want full women's tackle football leagues, just like hockey progressed. There's full hockey leagues. Those women go to college and play football in college on full ride scholarships. That's what I want, is that football to be a sport that not even less concerned about the professional level, but through the college level. Because to me, as cool as it is to play like through club and do all these things, college is such a huge thing for so many kids that miss opportunities. And so if we can get it into the universities and have full scholarships for these kids, to me, that's clutch. Because then after that, then you have, you know, a huge pool of talent to really push the sport and get spectators and all of that. But that's what I would like to see is for it to get into the universities the way that women's hockey did. In 20 years, I think that could be realistic.
Honestly, one of the biggest things is, like, I'm hoping, you know, in 20 years that we do have it down to one league that everybody plays in. Because right now we have two or three different leagues and it divides us. I think at some point we all need to come together and see the bigger picture that we all want the same thing. So we need to create one league to where we can achieve it, not three different leagues trying to fight to, you know, be the top league.
Football as a sport draws a very broad demographic, and overall in general it's not as expensive over the years to play. That's why you see so many different types of people play, and I think is what we're missing is that we have that opportunity for men or young boys, but we're missing that for women is the female athletes, that there really isn't a sport for them, whether it's too expensive, it's just not available, or their athletic type just can't mold into a certain sport. And so for me, I want to see the sport progress because I feel like we can capture so many young girls and change their lives.
That was Alicia Edlin and Mackenzie Tolliver from the Seattle Majestics. They won a division title this year, and Mackenzie made the 2017 USA Women's Tackle football team. You can watch game video and get 2018 season tickets at the Majestics website. We're tweeting out a link now. This is The Record. You're listening to The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. And we're at the end of 2017. The end of the year, of course, means end of the year roundup lists. Merriam-Webster Dictionary picked its word of the year, as it does every year. This year, it was feminism. Beginning with the Women's March, ending with the Me Too movement, are we looking at a year that will lead to meaningful change for women? Or are we looking at another media trend that will eventually fade away like the others? We'd love to know what you think. Give us a call at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869. And with me, Eula Bino, one third of the podcast, Hella Black, Hella Seattle. Hi, Eula.
Hello, hello.
So what do you think? Are we looking at meaningful change here or a media trend?
I think it's in between.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting when you say that, I go, oh man, I feel like my first thought is it's a media trend.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I want to have more hope and faith in the world. You know, I do feel like the way the country has like pushed us so aggressively towards ugly, people are reacting really positively towards love. And so I do think that like women are at the forefront of that and will create a lot of change. And I think that if we just stop looking for validation in it, we'll be fine. Like, I feel so bad for Hillary. Like, it sucked. But I feel like she also was like, I'm already great. And then she went on a hike. So if we just get more in line with that, we'll be fine.
I love that you're somewhere in the middle of this, of between. But
it sounds really good to make it the word of the year.
Uh-huh.
But like, I don't know. What else? What have past words of the year been? Like, was Bootylicious one of the year's words?
That would be amazing, but I don't think that Merriam-Webster chose
it's
that.
In the dictionary, though.
Yeah. It is in the dictionary.
So, like, my point is people honor things when they honor things, but that doesn't mean it changes the history of it.
Yeah. Well, but we're also, I mean, you know, Time Magazine put the Silence Breakers on the, you know, the cover this year as the person of the year, right? Mostly women who, you know, talked about sexual harassment, sexual assault at work, although the woman who actually started Me Too was not on the cover. I mean, is that meaningful? Does that tell us? I'm asking you to predict, right? Does that mean
she doesn't need the validation from that, like, to, in order to, you know, she creates the Me Too movement saying, I too have gone through this trauma. I hope she doesn't need the validation from men, right? Right, probably, or white women saying, like, yeah, you're so smart to create that term. She did it and it's done. It makes me think of, you know, that Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog song by Elvis Presley.
Yes.
And you know how everyone knows it was written by a black woman first? Like if you talk to black people, they're like, yeah, duh, it was like a song. It was a hit. It wasn't like a secret. So, you know, people will remix history and make it what they want to make it, but we'll always know the truth, which is good. Twitter keeps records.
Yeah. Thank you, Twitter. You're like society's archive, basically,
at
this point.
For everything. I mean, you guys have the best receipts on Donald Trump. Because it's all his own words, his own sick words.
I want to get back to this idea of whether we're looking at meaningful change. What for you would have to happen for you to say, oh, gosh, okay, this is actually a thing?
Yeah, for feminism to be actually a thing?
Yes. For this to be meaningful change for women.
To not have Donald Trump be our president. I know it sounds really interesting, but I think about him as like the most predatorial character I've ever experienced in my life. And so as we are busy calling out all of these men, you know, I too have been gone through this trauma due to a man. And there are women speaking up against Trump too, which I think is fantastic. But he still sits in office without that being worthwhile of him being, you know, kicked out. So that would be a really, that's a big dream. What's a small
dream? That's a high marker. Yeah, high marker.
Equal pay, I'll take. In the meantime.
Either we need to remove the president from office or women need to get equal pay.
Yeah.
One of those
two. We're shooting too high, right? Let's go way lower.
I would love equal pay to be a
thing. Girls' baby clothes not being only in pink.
Okay.
Not too high still?
Well, As the mother of a daughter, I would love that. That would be amazing.
But like everything I'm saying, can we just do on our own without anybody else like making this change happen? Because like I don't know how to sew, but I know folks who do. Hence, we'll get baby clothes without, you know, pink requirements.
That's an excellent point. We could actually rely on our friends and neighbors for this stuff. Is what we're saying here.
I think the biggest, you know, I was telling your producer earlier that remind me how to say your name.
Ajua
earlier, how I really feel like feminism is a great word. But for me, and what I feel closely tied to me this year was community. You know, I feel like that was like the biggest like takeaway for me. I feel like Seattle did this beautiful thing where our reaction to, you know, the bad in the world was to come together more and to talk more and to be together more and to ask, you know, hard questions and give hard answers. And not every interaction I had did that. But I feel like, you know, feminism was great, but so was, you know, community.
Mm-hmm. I like that as the word of the year.
Me too.
We're talking about whether the fact that feminism is the word of the year, the fact that Time magazine put the Silence Breakers on the cover of their magazine, whether this has been a watershed year for women, whether we're looking at meaningful change for women or whether we're looking at a media trend. We're wondering what you think. Give us a call, 206-543-5869. Again, that number is 206-543-5869. If, like Eula, you've got a couple of benchmarks for what you'd like to see before you're going to say, yes, we are on the precipice of some big, meaningful change for women, tell us about those benchmarks as well. 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. And Eula, I just wanted to point out, we did find out what the 2016 word of the year is. It's surreal.
Okay.
Which seems appropriate.
Which is so cute.
Yes.
It's like, how do you react? What has this whole year been about? 2016, Trump wins. It's surreal.
So
it was.
Well, I love the fact that I want to go back to what you said initially, that you were in between these two spots of meaningful change, just a media trend.
Yes.
Initially, I thought you were firmly in the no camp.
Yeah.
No meaningful change.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, I think no meaningful change, right? But on the other hand, I'm really proud of how many men have lost positions of power because of these women speaking out, right? So I don't know if that's feminism necessarily, or it's, you know, I don't know what word it is, but to me, it doesn't feel like feminism. Feminism to me feels like uniting around, you know, causes for women to become better, you know, like, or to be more recognized and be, like, equal pay would be like the, like, a real answer for that. To me, the way we're calling men out is justice. Yeah, more justice, I think, because, yeah, these men deserve that.
Well, I want to, what does justice look like for you? Because just as you sort of described what feminism looks like for you, I think justice can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So what does it look like for you, do you think?
The fair card. You know, it's interesting. When I was growing up, I always said, you know, I love the idea of fairness, you know, and kids really get fair. Because if you explain to them, you know, here are two apples and I'm going to give Donald 99% of the two apples and you get 1%. You're going to look at this and be like, that's not fair. And that's a really great concept. And to me, justice looks like what we all know to be fair and equal.
Hmm.
You know, I look back on this year and one of my highlights, and it's going away a little bit away from feminism, but is how in that jury trial for, is it Walter Scott, how the cop got jail time?
Mm-hmm.
That was the most fair thing that happened in such a long time for people of color. And we didn't really talk about it. But like, that's what I would love to be a word of the year, justice and fair one time. But yeah, those white men deserved it. So send them all, get them all fired in a way.
We're talking about whether the fact that feminism is the 2017 word of the year, the fact that we've seen the Me Too movement bring forth all these stories of sexual misconduct at work, whether that means that we're looking at some real changes for women or whether we're looking at a media trend here. We'd love to hear from you. 206-543-5869. Pam is calling from First Hill. Pam, what do you think about this?
To be successful And for us to get what I call beyond the Neanderthal stage is for the men to break their man code.
Okay, you need to tell me what that means. That's interesting.
It's the code that they have that has kept them from telling on each other when they know bad things are going on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. Okay.
If you want to know more about it, Terry Crews, the actor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I love
Terry
Crews.
He has written a book called Manhood, and he talks about it in there. And it's what's allowed the fellas to get away with so much evil for so long. And if the guys want a better world, they're going to have to work at it instead of hiding the bad stuff.
So we've seen, that's a good point. We've seen Terry Crews speak out about what happened to him. I haven't personally seen many, many men come forward and say, I've seen this. I'm going to speak up the next time. This is how I'm going to be a better ally. Mm-hmm. There's been no sort of corresponding men's movement along with Me Too. There's no hashtag for men. So, what do you think it would mean if we started seeing something like that, Pam?
Well, I think in order to encourage them to do that, they need to understand the seriousness of allowing this evil to continue. For example, what's happening to the oceans, our atmosphere, constant war. You know, it has a ripple effect, and the world really can be better. There, for example, in Rwanda right now, women are being treated with a lot more respect because when the genocide was going on, the sons saw how much better the mothers were handling the situations that were happening as opposed to the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Women tend to be emotionally stronger in crises situations and have better values at how to handle things than to be... You know, to want to fight and find out who's the toughest guy, kind of a attitude.
Pam, thank you so much for that phone call. That idea of breaking the man code, that's something to move forward with and think about. I'm curious to know what you think as well. If you think 2017 is the beginning of meaningful change for women, what would need to happen for you to think 2017, something happened, and it's still moving forward. This isn't just a media trend we're seeing here. 206-543-5869. Again, that number is 206-543-5869. I'm talking with Eula Bino. She's one third of the podcast, Hella Black, Hella Seattle. Mm-hmm. You're also a doula. Yeah. You're a mother. You ID yourself on Twitter as a full-time Black woman.
I do it all day.
You do all the things all day. Yeah. Why was it important to call all of those things out?
Because they're all different levels of who I am. You know, I really identify as a Seattleite. I very much identify as a woman. I am a woman. I'm a person of color. And, you know, it's interesting how we all wear this on our skin, and it's so much a forefront of who we are, but it's sometimes easier to call it out, too. I don't ever want, you know, I know nobody gets confused through an email because my name is Eula, and I think it sounds like it could be Black, but I want people to know on top of it. I'm confident in that. I'm confident in being a Black woman. And I'll show up and be a Black person when I get there, too. Don't think you're invited someone else.
Well, I feel like...
No, because that can happen. You know, where people invite someone and they hope that you won't speak on who you are. They hope that you'll hide parts of yourself, you know, in the office or in the boardroom, and you'll just show up at just a level of, like, you know, the part that they want to invite in. But all of me shows up to all of my experiences.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about in terms of who shows up where and who you get to be in which place. I mean, I feel like we saw that play out a little bit on a national level in terms of how many white women voted for Donald Trump, how many white women voted for the Alabama GOP candidate Roy Moore versus how many Black women voted for Roy Moore. I mean, what do you think those kinds of divisions are telling us about what's happening, especially as we're looking at words like feminism, as we're looking at words like, you know, Me Too, as though we're all sort of moving forward together?
Well, there are a lot of people out there who think of feminism as a really ugly, terrible word. And a lot of people are women. You know, I always think back to this story. If you guys have a chance, please listen to this podcast called Making Oprah. I don't know.
I love that podcast.
Oh, my gosh. Do you remember the part when Oprah is talking about how she brings a woman in? She's talking about self. The woman asks the crowd, what priority are you on your own priority list? And then, you know, people give answers. And the woman says, well, you should be number one. And the crowd booed her. Can you believe that?
The crowd booed her episode.
Because what they were saying was, I'm not supposed to come first as a woman. I'm supposed to put my children first, my husband first. I'm supposed to be the backbone of my home versus the, you know, the face of it. And I think think a lot of people in all these places where people have moved away, and the ones who were, I hate thinking how so many smart people have moved to Seattle, you know, LA, New York, Chicago, you know, parts of, you know, Atlanta, I imagine. But they just left all these other small towns with all these dummies. And I know that sounds terrible, but they just left us, or they left them. And so now they've been able to really, you know, hone and create a society that really puts women down from the very beginning. And they think little of themselves for so long that when they finally have the power to vote in their own favor, they think, but my husband, but my son, but, you know, everyone else tells me I'm supposed to do this. So they fall right in line.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot more questions for you, Eula, but I wanted to ask, as we look forward to this next year, I think I have an idea of how you're going to answer this question, but where are you going to be looking for hope? Where are you going to be looking for signs that, you know what, there is some meaningful change actually happening here?
So more in my community, right? I'm going to be looking for my community to show up and invite me into spaces that are filling and fulfilling. But also, I'm going to be looking to men. Which I know my mind sounds silly, but I have a new son. I had a baby named Livingston, and he is 3 months old. And it's been interesting to have to change my lens from, you know, women are strong, men are, and to I have a man that I'm going to be raising myself. And how am I going to create him into being someone who takes off that man coat, speaks up for other men, speaks up for women? And I, you know, and I hold him account. I'm going to make sure I hold him accountable. That's one of my fears of what happened in 2017, you know. In 2016, people got fired a lot for saying the wrong thing about racial, you know, along racial lines. Now people are being fired for the wrong they do to women, but there's not a lot of conversation and accountability and trainings that go around it. So I'm hoping that the future brings us, you know, more community and more conversations about what we need to actually see to implement change around feminism, sexism, racism, that kind of thing.
That idea of accountability is really intriguing. And I wonder what that, again, what that looks like for you, especially as you've talked about these other really kind of wonderful words, these positive ideas of community, of love. I mean, what does loving accountability look like?
I mean, if a man does terrible things to a woman, and I mean, when I say terrible, I think not all the way as far as rape, right? Because that's not a lot of what the men have been accused of, but just really unjust acts that are vulgar and, you know, and inappropriate. What that would look like to me is a conversation with that woman that really breaks down, these are all the levels of what really upset me. And then another woman coming in and saying, you know, so this is what we need to do. And then a man coming in and saying, I used to think how you thought, and now I think so much better because of these things that I've learned, and I'm happier, and I've gained, you know, we gain so much from seeing each other.
We have one final call before we wrap this segment up. Amy calling from Seattle. Hi.
Hi.
So what do you think about 2017? Have we seen a year of real change?
Well, I don't know if it's real change yet. I mean, there's certainly been a lot of things exposed that should be. And I think Trump's election is certainly, you know, it, in one way, it's like kind of busting a pimple. You know, everything is coming, all the pus is coming out to the surface. But I'm sorry, that isn't what I called to say. I was just going to say, the whole Me Too movement, I'm 54, and, you know, I don't know anyone my age who hasn't gone through a lot of this, you know, kind of harassment and stuff. And I think it's been great that these guys have been outed, especially the ones in power. I would really like to see more of the men in Congress who are, you know, protected being outed. But I think what we really need, apart from my, I mean, it's like, I want to get mad, you know, about the, I mean, I want to get justice.
Yeah.
But I keep, you mentioned Rwanda earlier, and I thought about South Africa too, and the Truth and Reconciliation commissions that they had. And I think one of the problems, the biggest problem is that we're not talking to each other.
Yes.
And so men I know feel like this is all an attack on all men, so how do they get to the conversation? And I've also heard that, you know, from some of my white friends about the Black Lives Matter movement of saying, you know, they feel like they can't do anything right because they are white, you know. And I think we need to listen to each other a lot more, but some kind of truth and reconciliation thing where, you know, women and men sit down together in public forums and actually, you know, talk about these events.
Amy, that's an amazing idea.
It would take a lot of courage on a guy's part.
It does.
To do that. But maybe we would get further along.
Hmm. Amy, thank you so much for that phone call and that idea, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I like that a lot. And Eula Bino from Hella Black, Hella Seattle, mm-hmm. doula, podcaster, new mom.
Yes, too good.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It was great to talk with you, and we'll bring you back again. I'd love to talk with you some more.
I'm down.
This is The Record from KUOW. You're listening to The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. What would you do if immigration agents came to your door or to your job? Here in Washington, one group wants residents to call a hotline so someone can be dispatched to help. This on-the-ground network reflects wider efforts to protect immigrants at risk of deportation and go beyond the label of a sanctuary city or sanctuary state. Liz Jones of KUOW's Race and Equity team has a story. And a quick note, the first speaker in our story asked to only use his first name to protect his privacy.
Morning traffic streams past a busy intersection in a South Seattle neighborhood. It's a largely Latino community where a young man named Jose grew up. We've withheld his last name to protect his privacy. Jose shows me around outside an apartment building he manages.
Oh, so this is where they were, huh?
Well, I was standing here.
Oh, okay.
And this is where they came down.
Last month, Jose came rushing to the building after he got a call from an agent with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE.
He told me that he was here. He was trying to apprehend a suspect. So I was like, okay, I'm on my way. I'm the property manager. And then he asked me how soon, because we have six agents who are ready to enter the premises.
But when Jose arrived, he didn't see any officers. So he waited by the back entrance. Then a few agents stepped out of unmarked vehicles.
Yeah, there was a couple cars. There was two back there, one in the middle. One was actually out in the street. So they basically had the whole place around there.
Jose asked to see a warrant. The ICE agent handed him some papers.
I was just scanning for the word judge. I was making sure that it came from a court and it was actually signed by a judge.
Immigration agents often use what's called an administrative warrant, but only a judge's signature gives them legal permission to search private property. Jose knew what to look for. He handed the papers back.
And I said, I'm sorry, in order for me to let you enter the premises, I need to see a warrant signed by a judge.
After some back and forth, the agents returned to their cars. And Jose says the agents warned him.
And said, well, if you're not going to let us in, we're just going to stay out here all day and we're going to pick up anybody that comes in or leaves the property.
Jose waited. He knew help was on the way. Because before he raced over here, his first thought was to call a hotline built specifically for the situation.
Yes. As soon as I hopped in my car, I just pulled up the website, called the 1-844 number.
You have reached the Washington Immigrant Solidarity Network S reporting hotline.
Yeah, I was actually just on my way to work, and so I got the address and I just went right to the scene.
Victoria Mena is with the Washington Immigrant and Solidarity Network. Last spring, the group launched a statewide hotline for people to report ICE activity and a text message alert system to sound the alarm when necessary. Hundreds of people now subscribe to these alerts. When Jose called the hotline that morning, the network's rapid response team sprang into action.
You know, we ended up having three attorneys there, community members there, other organizations present. And so, you know, this is a clear example of how this network can really work.
Mena took photos of the unmarked vehicles. Within minutes, the agents left. ICE officials say they prioritize arrests of serious criminals. I ask Mena why her group would interfere.
We're not standing in their way of doing their job. We're just holding them accountable that they have to do the right thing and take the right process and procedures.
Mena says the hotline gets about a dozen calls a week. Often they're just rumors of ICE activity, so the network will verify and try to calm fears. The group also runs volunteer trainings across the state to build up the local response teams. Immigration officials declined to comment on this specific incident at Jose's building, but in an email statement, an agency spokeswoman said individuals who impede ICE officers, quote, recklessly endanger not only the enforcement personnel, but also the individuals targeted for arrest and potentially innocent bystanders. Jose, the building manager, still gets a bit rattled thinking back to that encounter with ICE.
Honestly, as they were walking towards me, I thought, is this it? is this where I'm going to get picked up and taken to a country that I really don't know?
Jose is undocumented, but he has temporary permission to stay and work here through DACA. It's a federal program for some immigrants who came to the U.S. illegally as children, and a program that's being phased out. After President Trump's election, Jose started attending Know Your Rights trainings. That's where he learned what to do if ICE ever stopped him, and also where he heard about the hotline. It was a game changer for him.
I wonder, you know, if you'd gotten the call and didn't know about the hotline, do you think you would have come here the way you did?
I probably wouldn't, honestly. Being in my situation with DACA, I probably would have just not put myself in that situation. But knowing that I had that network behind me, knowing that I had organizations here in the community that I can rely on, kind of gave me more confidence.
As we finish talking in the parking lot, a white SUV rolls by. It's clearly marked as Homeland Security. Then it drives on, down this street where Jose rode his bike as a kid. I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
It's KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today. And we've been talking about what 2017 has looked like here in the U.S. Canada is ending 2017 with its prime minister mired in controversy. That's according to our friend Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Jeannie.
So Justin Trudeau is mired in controversy. How so?
So he took a Christmas vacation with the Aga Khan, who is the billionaire leader of the world's Ismaili Muslims. Trudeau took his family to the Aga Khan's estate in the Bahamas. This is last year. And he was investigated for this. Took a free flight, free accommodation, whole family, his wife and the children. And it turns out that Trudeau's been found to have four times violated the country's ethics legislation. So he shouldn't have done it. You're not supposed to take free flights. You're not supposed to do this kind of freebies. A billionaire who does have some dealings with the Canadian government. And I think the other thing is that Trudeau was very unapologetic about it initially, insisted there was nothing wrong with it. Well, he's turned out to be the first prime minister in Canadian history who was found to have violated the ethics law. He's apologized, but it's pretty embarrassing nevertheless.
Well, in his approval rating, Justin Trudeau has recently slipped below 50%. I mean, do you think this controversy will mean that that approval rating continues to slide?
Well, I think he's got some making up to do in the new year. So he came in 2 years ago, and he's been very popular. You know, when he comes to do public appearances, he gets selfies. He's like a rock star. So he's very, very popular, especially with younger voters. But you're right. This is a blot on his record. And he looks stupid on it, really, because the law is pretty straightforward. And in this case, he claimed that the Aga Khan was an old family friend. Well, the Aga Khan was a friend of Trudeau's father when he was prime minister years and years ago, but Trudeau hasn't actually had any dealings with him in 30 years. So it's a pretty embarrassing thing, but it's year end. I think in the end, politicians tend to get judged on the economy and how well they keep their other promises. And look, the next election in Canada is still 2 years away, so he's got plenty of time to make it up.
I'm talking with Vaughn Palmer from the Vancouver Sun, and something new happened in BC, the first new government in 16 years. There's a long to-do list in terms of projects for this new government. How significant is all of this?
Well, we got a brand new government in British Columbia, and you're right, first time in 16 years. We don't change them very often here in British Columbia, and an unusual government. We had the closest election in BC history, very, very close result. New Premier John Horgan, he took power in partnership with the Green Party. So we've got the New Democrats, which is the party of the center-left, the one that's tied to the labor movement. And then we've got the Greens for the first time in a power-sharing arrangement anywhere in North America, certainly in Canada. So it's an unusual government, and they've done fairly well so far. They've had some controversies, approved a big hydroelectric dam in northeastern British Columbia that made many of their supporters unhappy. But they've made some progress on some other things, and the year-end opinion polls indicate that Premier John Horgan of British Columbia is the second most popular premier in Canada. So he's doing fairly well for a new government. A lot of stuff he has to do in the new year, a lot of unkept promises that he has to live up to, but so far, so good.
Well, I know one of the things that the new government wants to do is tackle the housing affordability crisis in BC, particularly in Vancouver. Will you keep us updated on how that goes? Because that's definitely relevant to Seattle's interests.
Yeah, these plans to do something about housing affordability, everybody wants to do something, but an awful lot of the stuff that people have tried so far haven't helped. Horgan is promising. It was the key to him winning the election, really, was a promise to do something about this, so he's got to live up to it in the new year. He brings in a budget and legislation in February, so we'll see what he does. What he says he's going to do is a tax on to discourage real estate speculation and measures to increase the housing supply as well. I will indeed keep you posted, because if any of this stuff works, British Columbians are going to be very, very happy. Our housing unaffordability problem is even greater in Vancouver than it is in Seattle.
Well, we'll definitely be watching what happens there. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jeannie.
I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. This has been The Record, and Bill's back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.